You're listening to Getting Lit with Linda Mora, the podcast where we welcome you to get lit. Canadian lit, that is. Join Linda as she talks about authors in Canada and sometimes with them, using her expertise to shed some light on recent and not so recent writers. And now, get ready for Getting Lit with Linda.
Hi, this is Linda Mora, the writer and host of Getting Lit with Linda. As a woman and a female scholar, I've often devoted a significant part of my life to the recovery of women's lives from history, to ferret out details and put them together to render stories coherent. I think of it as an act of respect and curiosity and compassion, an act of love, really, to be open to hearing about these lives that have been underrepresented, if they've been represented at all. I think of the Virginia Woolf song by the folk rock musical duo, the Indigo Girls. Don't worry if you don't know who they are. I'll have a link in my show notes. And about a woman's message in a bottle, that is Virginia Woolf's message, being carried through time. One that I've tried to pluck from the shorelines of history to pry open those bottles and read the messages with care and love. I also happen right now to be writing a biography about the writer and activist Jane Rule. Writing a biography involves a kind of faithfulness to the facts. A lack of fidelity would be a kind of betrayal to the life lived, to a woman's account to which I'm trying to give life and breath. But what happens when we try to imagine lives for which we don't have enough information or facts? Well, that's where the writer of historical fiction comes in. Enter Bryn Turnbull. And in this case, specifically, the historical fiction of Bryn Turnbull. She's written several books in this genre, including The Last Grand Duchess and The Woman Before Wallace. But in today's episode, Bryn and I discuss her work of historical fiction, The Paris Deception, in which two female characters collude in order to rescue paintings from the clutches of the Nazi regime during the Second World War, in this case set in Paris. Bryn makes reference to the Monuments Men a couple of times in this episode, a Second World War platoon tasked with rescuing art masterpieces from German thieves. There was also a movie based on the work of nonfiction called The Monuments Men, starring George Clooney, Matt Damon, and Hugh Bonneville, among others. And this was based on the book of the same title, but with the additional subtitle, Allied Heroes, Nazi Thieves, and the Greatest Treasure Hunt in History, by Robert M. Edsel. Turnbull's novel is a kind of female answer to this story, showing us how women performed heroically in history, and specifically during the Second World War, when women were often scapegoated. Her novel also offers us a counterbalance to the male gaze and patriarchal historical record, demonstrating that women were not only as capable as men, but also used their invisibility to their advantage to undertake, in this novel, for example, the Paris Deception. If you want to know what that deception was, you'll have to listen to the episode and then read the book. This is my interview with Bryn Turnbull. Hi, Bryn, and welcome to Getting Lit with Linda.
Hi, Linda. It's so nice to be on the show with you. Thank you so much for having me.
I was so fascinated by this novel. I was really captivated by it. And in particular about the two main characters and their story, Sophie and Fabian, who are initially antagonists. And they come together to collaborate on, of course, the title of your book, This Paris Deception, that is the way of rescuing paintings from a destructive Nazi agenda. So tell the listeners, how did this idea for this particular novel come about?
You know, this book kind of came about through a number of different threads that all wound together in my mind. I think it almost feels a bit like a rite of passage. I think for historical fiction novelists to write their Second World War book, I've read so many of them. It's a genre and it's a time period that I keep sort of coming back to. Mm. knowing that, though, I wanted to write something a little bit different. And I had recently read about an art forger, a Dutch art forger named Han van Meegeren, who sold a fake Vermeer to Hermann Göring. And I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. That's a story I haven't heard before. So I started looking into the art, you know, what happened with art during the Second World War. I mean, I knew I'd watched the Monuments Men. I knew about the Monuments Men. I knew sort of that there was this looting that took place during the war. The Nazis were responsible for the theft of 20% of Europe's art. And to this day, over 100,000 works of art are still unaccounted for. It's astounding. And the majority of these works of art, of course, were stolen from Jewish families, from victims of the Holocaust. So I was sort of already moving a little bit in that direction when my brother came to me and asked me, it's always a sibling, right?
Isn't it?
So my brother came to me and said, my first book I dedicated to my sister, my second book I dedicated to my grandmother. And he said, I want you to, like, when am I getting my book? When are you dedicating a book to me? And I said, well, what do you want me to write about? Here's kind of where this book is going. And he said, thought about it for a minute and said, my favorite movie is The Thomas Crown Affair. I want you to write something that I'll like as much as The Thomas Crown Affair. So that's where the heist aspect of this book comes in.
Not a tall order. No, not at all.
Tall order in the slightest.
I guess he was setting you up for a challenge, and it's a challenge you met. I'm not that familiar with the genre, but I couldn't put the book down. I enjoyed it so much.
Thank you.
Given the references to the major paintings, you've been discussing some of the theft that was going on, paintings by Salvador Dali or Pablo Picasso that went missing. Would you speak to us about the kind of research that was involved in writing an historical novel set during the Second World War that deals with such painters and such painting and the visual art community in France and more broadly in Europe? What kind of research did you have to undertake?
This is my third novel, and I would say it's my most heavily researched by far. I spent about 6 years researching this book.
What?
Yeah, about 6 years. Because I didn't have a background in art history. I really was not all that knowledgeable about the art world and about all of these artists. I mean, I knew them sort of peripherally. I knew which artists I liked, but I didn't know the history of, say, surrealism. I didn't know the history of cubism. Mm-hmm. And that was all very important for me to have to capture. I mean, the main character, one of the main characters, Sophie, is an art conservator.
Yes, exactly.
So that adds a whole extra level of detail that I needed. Not only do I need to know about the paintings involved, I need to know about what art conservation is and how, you know, what are the tools that she would be using? What are the techniques that she'd be using to restore works of art? So it was a lot of research.
Oh, I bet.
But that's my favorite part of the process. I love kind of diving into it. So with this novel, I started with art conservation. That was really kind of where I went first. And it was through an old roommate of mine, actually, from my days as an undergraduate at McGill, who had a friend in the conservation community in New York City. And through this friend, I was able to get private tours of the conservation labs at the Met, MoMA, and the Museum of Natural History.
I feel a surge of jealousy. It's all good, but I feel a surge of jealousy.
Oh, it was the most magical day ever, honestly. At one point, there's a painting that I reference in the book in a flashback scene where Fabienne meets her future husband. There's a particular painting that she's focused on by Van Gogh, and I put it in because when I went to MoMA, they were restoring that painting. It was right there in the lab, and I got to come right up close to it and see it. I had absolute shivers when I saw it. It was unbelievable.
Those who haven't yet read the book won't know that there are these elaborate passages about art restoration. Did you have someone who was in art restoration read over the passages to make sure that it was exact, that the details in terms of art restoration were being respected?
I didn't. And there was a very kind of conscious reason for this. On the one hand, I wanted to kind of pass all this along. On the other, I did a lot of research on this myself, and I didn't want to get bogged down so much in the technicality. You know, a reader of the novel doesn't need to know absolutely everything. We want to give the flavor and we want to give like an accurate representation of what that work is. But the worry is going kind of so far down the rabbit hole that you lose sight of the plot. So I kind of had to pull myself back in a lot of moments. I mean, with art forgery as well, I had to pull myself out of the hole of going into the technical aspects of it because I found them so fascinating.
I think there was an interview with Amy Tan. I think it was Amy Tan who was saying that when you start doing historical research, you can go down these rabbit holes. And she said that one of those rabbit holes involved the kinds of toilet paper that one used like 200 mm-hmm. years ago or something like that. I thought, what did one use, right? But she said, you could potentially get mired in all of these details. What you do so well is that you include the details and the details render it highly visual. So you have this nicely refined visual sense, which makes me understand too, that you as a writer also have an appreciation for visual art. So I wondered, I wondered if there were three paintings that you could have rescued, which ones they would have been.
No one's ever asked me that before. That's a really, really good question. So all of the paintings that I reference by name in this book were paintings that were looted by the Nazis.
I wondered about that. I was going to ask you. That was one of my following questions.
Every single one of them was looted by the Nazis. There's a website, a database that came out of the Monuments Men and Women's work called the ERR Project. And it's a database. They have every work of art that passed through the Jeu de Paume Museum when the Nazis were using it as this sorting house for looted artwork. Mm. So it was important to me that every painting that I referenced by name actually was there. I didn't want to include any paintings that weren't there. And I wanted to make sure that I was discussing who they actually belonged to and, you know, whose families
were affected.
Whose families were affected. So, you know, for example, Paul Rosenberg, who was a very prominent art dealer in Paris at the time. Mm. And then after the war in New York, just countless works of art that he owned were in this museum. So that's a very long-winded way of saying, you know, if there were a couple works of art that I would want, that I would have saved myself if I was there, Salvador Dali's Swans Reflecting Elephants is one that I've always just felt sort of an affinity towards. And you know, we have to bear in mind a lot of these paintings that were targeted by the Nazis were targeted for a very specific purpose. They were targeted because they were ideologically impure in the Nazis' parlance. They were degenerate paintings. And so really what that means is they represented, you know, a way of thinking that the Nazis couldn't control. They represented avant-garde thought, things outside the status quo. And, you know, Dali is such a representational artist in that regard. You know, Picasso, another one, of course, his paintings were there. There was one actually of Paul Rosenberg's wife, Madame Rosenberg et sa fille.
Yes.
And yeah, that again is one that I think it's such a beautiful painting and it's so almost unexpected given you think Picasso and you think cubism, but he had so many different art movements and artistic styles that he worked within. And so this painting of, you know, this portrait doesn't look on first glance like a Picasso.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just beautiful.
Amazing. So you have this eye for visual detail, but you also have a sense for gender. And so I thought, let's turn to gender as a point of discussion. So much of this novel relies on the idea of gender. Is there an irony that the very people, the women, are the main characters, who are trying to save these paintings are paintings that have largely been done by men? How do you approach that?
You are asking really wonderful questions, I have to say.
It was something that I noticed, that the two main female characters who don't get to have, so Fabienne, for example, wants to be an artist and whose life is derailed, her artistic career is derailed, but then she becomes involved in trying to protect the paintings of men.
Yeah, this is very much a book about gender. I agree with you. And I don't want to say the limitations placed upon women. I don't think that that's a fair representation of what it is, but
in part,
yes. And you know, these characters use their gender in different ways. They use their femininity in different ways. You know, Sophie, for example, is gay, and she has to hide that because yes. of the time and the place. And to me, when I was writing the book, that wasn't so much, it wasn't so much a rumination on gender as it was a rumination on the concept of degeneracy as defined by the Germans, as defined by the Nazis, because all of these art movements were considered degenerate. Of course, the Nazis had very firm ideas on who was pure and who was not pure. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I wanted to do in this book was I wanted to have representations from different characters of what this degeneracy, in scare quotes, mm-hmm. was. And this degeneracy was individual, very regular humans living their lives. It was gay people. It was, you know, it was Jewish people. It was political dissidents. And so that to me was what I was trying to represent with these different characters was mm-hmm. if we look at what the Nazis were considering as degenerate, at some point it includes everybody.
Mm. I strongly identified with the female characters, which is probably why I was asking the question related yeah. to gender. So yeah. I thought, why choose female protagonists to undertake mm-hmm. the kind of underground rescue of major paintings? What kinds of gendered practices made their role both credible and incredible?
One of the historical inspirations for this story was Rose Vallant, who was a resistance operative who worked within the Jeux du Pont Museum. And she concealed the fact that she spoke German. She had a photographic memory, and she was able to keep these databases in her mind of all of these paintings. And this formed the basis of the ERR project later. And it was really through her that I developed Sophie as a character and was able to really look at what, you know, what is the role, what is the emphasis that different groups put on women.
We can think about these women seemingly doing these mundane tasks.
Yes.
Art restoration. And yet, so that's yes. what makes it credible. But then what they end up doing is incredible. And we have this historical basis or foundation for what is so incredible.
And that really was the history of resistance at this time period. It was ordinary people doing incredible things, doing extraordinary things. And so many of these people were women. I mean, of course they were women. Mm. History, one of the things that I find very fascinating about historical fiction writ large is the notion that the historical record has been written in the Western world far too long. It's been written by men. Mm-hmm. And it's the male gaze, it's the male perspective that we are given in these historical accounts. And with historical fiction, we have an opportunity to write back in the stories of women.
I love it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And so with Sophie and Fabienne, I really wanted to have a representation of what female resistance looks like. And you know, the Nazis discounted the strength of women. They took science and math off of the curriculum for young girls and replaced it Incredible. With sewing and homemaking. They did not believe that women were capable of extraordinary things. And so with Sophie and Fabienne, I wanted to turn that on its head by showing not these women being prototypically masculine heroes, blowing up railway lines and things. Mm-hmm. Not to say that women can't do that. Of course they can. But I wanted it to be, I wanted there to be a subtlety to what they were doing, which allowed them to do it right under the Nazis' noses, right in plain sight. That's a refrain that I have throughout the book is hide in plain sight. And I think that's the strength of what they were doing.
I think that's exactly right. I love the fact that they were both deeply intelligent, but because the Nazis with whom they were interacting didn't expect that intelligence, mm-hmm. It did, as you say, it allowed them to get away with so much. So along those lines, I want to talk a little bit about deception. I'm going to read a passage to you from your own novel and then draw a question from it. On page 232, there's a moment when I think it's Fabienne who's doing this. She would sand down the painting surfaces, obliterating the layers of varnish and impasto, then paint over whatever remained with a new shining white ground upon which to work, destroying the paintings beneath to make way for her necessary deceptions. But the remnants of the original painting would still be there, concealed beneath the surface, a history hidden, but not forgotten by those who knew where to look. It's a great moment in the novel. And so I immediately put the novel down and thought, okay, when are deceptions necessary? Is there such a thing as a necessary deception?
Well, I mean, I certainly think so.
Obviously.
I absolutely think that there is a place for a necessary deception. And I think it's a difficult thing, though, because
it is
a deception is necessary in pursuit of the greater good. But what is the greater good? You know, we have characters in this novel. Conrad Richter comes to mind, who believes that he is deceiving for the greater good as well. You know, his actions within the museum would also fall into that category. So there is some mental gymnastics, I think, that have to take place in order to deceive effectively. But that's not to say that it's universally wrong.
Yes, but with Richter, the necessary deception doesn't apply because he's profiting from the paintings that are being stolen. So it's
but he thinks he's doing the right thing. He thinks that he's saving them by lining his own pockets.
Yes, yes, but it doesn't follow the definition of what you've suggested, which is the greater good. That's a personal good, personal advancement, or it's really about satisfying his ego.
But at what point does self-deception come into that narrative? Because Conrad is very clearly deceiving himself about what the greater good is.
Yes. There are a series of deceptions that take place throughout the course of the novel. Mm-hmm. I won't say what the other ones are. Some of them really threw me for a loop toward the end of the novel. I wasn't anticipating them at all. And so that was
one.
Yes. So that was also really quite surprising. But again, the deceptions I thought were necessary in order to circumvent a power structure that was absolutely destructive and mm-hmm. malevolent. And I thought that's when we know we also have a necessary deception in order to save people's lives. We're also saving paintings, not just lives. So I wanted to ask you about that too. What's the risk or the risks in speaking about saving paintings when there are lives at risk?
So, I mean, that was something that I did really think about while I was writing this book. And I mean, Sophie says it at one point, I'm not going to be the one blowing up a railway line. I'm not going to be the one saving people's lives, but I'm doing what I can do within my own sphere of influence. This, to me, the reality of France during the occupation, I think the number is hovers somewhere between, I think, 10 and 15% of French people actively joined the resistance during the Second World War.
Wow.
It's an extraordinary number, but it's a lot smaller than I think modern works of fiction, modern storytelling would have us believe. A lot of fiction that's set during this time period, I mean, we look at it with the benefit of hindsight. We say, of course, we would have joined the resistance. Of course, we would have done the right thing. And we would have stood up against oppression and against this malevolent hatred. But the reality of the time is that wasn't what always happened. That's not to say that people didn't resist. And that's not to say that people didn't take risks. Mm. It's to say that they didn't necessarily take them within the formalized structure of capital R resistance. Mm. So that to me was what I wanted to look at. What does resistance look like on the smallest possible level? What does it look like if the only way that you can resist is in your own heart and in your own head and within the confines of your four walls? So for these characters, their resistance is taking the form of what they can control, and it's taking the form of what they have influence over, which is the artwork. And I mean, we have to bear in mind this artwork represents so much more than the art itself. It represents the artistic movements that are captured on the canvas. And it also represents the cultural legacies of the families that rightfully own these works of art, which cannot be discounted. You know, even today, 100,000 works of art are still missing. And these families are still trying to find out what happened to the possessions of their grandparents and great-grandparents. So for me, it was very much, what does resistance look like on the smallest level? And what was the impact of the Holocaust, not only on human life, but on everything else that followed that we're still feeling the reverberations of today?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. This novel is so much about power and the powerless. And in fact, that is a kind of refrain in your novel as well. So this is on page 184 when you say, and again, it's an italicized, so you're drawing our attention to it. It starts silently to those too powerless to resist. I wonder if there's a warning in your novel that you're issuing here, and what kind of warning is it?
Very, very much so. I mean, we're living, every generation, I think, feels that it's living through extraordinary times. But it's not exaggeration to say that we are. We're seeing the rise of the far right all across the world.
Yes.
And I'm looking from the perspective of a historian. And to me, the historical parallels are very clear. I wrote this book very shortly after the January 6th insurrection.
Oh, wow.
And one of the questions that I had was, what does radicalization look like in its earliest stages? How do you get to the point where a family member is storming the Capitol? What does that look like? How did they get there? So it very much felt like a warning when I was writing it. It felt like a warning when I was doing the research, because I just kept seeing modern day parallels that were just unbelievably chilling.
The parallels are striking, which is why I'm raising this question. And I felt it when I was reading the novel, that the warning could be issued in a contemporary moment. So I have another question about the kind of power and powerlessness and intimacy and betrayal in particular. Intimacy and betrayal is a theme in this particular novel. How or why is betrayal a function of intimacy? How does it work?
I don't think you can betray somebody that you are not close to. It's not a betrayal to cheat somebody. It doesn't hurt them. It doesn't hurt somebody to betray them unless you have that intimate closeness, unless you have that relationship with them where you've put yourself in a position of vulnerability, where you've put yourself in a position to trust. I think those two things go very much hand in hand.
So it happens in relationships between, for example, Sophie and Richter. And so she very deliberately sidles up to Richter and becomes not fully intimate with him, but quite intimate with him in order to betray him. That's the entire plan. But it struck me as remarkable that there were a number of moments when those who were part of France, who are French citizens, who felt betrayed by their own country, that there's a kind of intimacy at work there too, that we have this belief that this won't happen in France. There's no way that this will happen here, a sense of incredulity about what's unfurling in the country around them. And so there's also betrayal on a national scale, because there's that expected sense of proximity that fails. So this comes
very
back
much
to,
so.
It comes back to the idea of power and powerlessness. And again, my asking you about how that's unfurling in the novel on various levels.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think that we all have a dependency, and we have a trust in our systems of government and in our societal networks. And when those fail, we can't quite believe it, because of course it's not going to happen here. It can't happen here because I'm part of this system. I'm part of it, and I would never do that, right? I think it's easy, particularly for these characters, the rapid dissemination of information the way that we do today as well. So I think they had to put a lot of trust in their institutions.
Mm.
And so when those institutions failed them, I think they were really profoundly shocked and, as you mentioned, as you said, betrayed. There was a real sense of betrayal. And, you know, we see in the way that the French kind of acted at the end of the war, there was a real intimate backlash against each other, really, against other people in their midst who they felt collaborated, who they felt had betrayed them, had betrayed France. It all really kind of goes together. There was a whole section of the book that dealt with that, which I ended up taking out. But
why is that? Why did you take that part out?
Well, initially the book ended with both Fabienne and Sophie being hauled out and shot as collaborators.
You did not have that as the original ending.
I did.
And why did you change it?
Well, because, I mean, it would have been just too dark and too sad. But women were the ones who bore a lot of the blame at the end of the war. They were the ones who kind of became the symbolic oppressors in a strange way. They were the ones who had slept with the Germans. And so it was their fault for doing that, not the fault of the men who economically collaborated. Women were very convenient scapegoats. Yes, and so seeing the position that Sophie was in, working in the museum during the war, it would have been easy for people to think that she was a collaborator.
Mm.
So initially that was kind of where I had intended to go, but I felt that would be kind of too cruel an ending to kill them both.
It is. But what you do instead is you offer us a kind of counterbalance in the relationship between Fabienne and Sophie. So again, we've been talking about betrayal and intimacy, but they actually offer us a real intimacy that is productive and collaborative, and interestingly, between two women. So I wondered mm-hmm. if you could also just speak to that a little bit about that choice to choose those two characters and then to bring them into this circle where they start off being quite hostile with each other and then end mm-hmm. in a completely different place than where they started.
To give some necessary context to listeners who maybe haven't read the book, Sophie and Fabienne are sisters-in-law. And there is a very, very deep wound at the heart of their relationship as sisters-in-law. And that's where we meet them at the start of the novel. I knew that I wanted to make them sisters-in-law. That just, it felt right that they would have this bond that neither of them actively chose, but that kept them tied together. Mm. However, it would have been too easy to make them friends. Mm. It would have been far too easy to make them friends. And so I wanted it to be a relationship with people who know that they can trust each other, but don't like each other.
Yes, exactly.
And don't, yeah.
That is exactly what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wanted to see how that relationship changed over time. And I didn't want it to be a romantic relationship. I didn't want there to be yes. some man that both of, like, I didn't want it to be a relationship where both of them were, had been in love with the same man. That felt too melodramatic. And let's be serious. Women can have relationships that have nothing to do with men, right? Come on.
That's in part why I enjoyed it so much. It's that this friendship is at the core, and it's mm-hmm. a friendship that's not easily built. They have to rebuild it over time for various reasons. Readers, you'll just have to find out by picking up the book. But that's also what drew me in, that this friendship that is at the core of the narrative and then creates that sense of solidarity and that drives the narrative forward. It's so compelling.
Thank you. Just one more thing to add to that. I wanted their relationship to be one, I wanted their trust in each other to be one based on competence, on their mutual competence and their mutual skill sets. And the respect, they didn't have to like each other, but they respected each other for what the other one could do and what they could bring to this partnership that they built together. I thought that was important, to have two supremely competent women on the page.
Well, Bryn, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Linda. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. You asked me so many interesting questions. Thank you so much.
And that was my interview with Bryn Turnbull. please join me in the next episode when I talk about the Québécois writer Marie-Claire Blais and her landmark novel, Mad Shadows. And yes, the episode will be in English and in French. Thanks for listening as always, my dear listeners.
That was Getting Lit with Linda, hosted by Linda Mora. If you have a topic you would like to hear covered, write to us at gettinglitwithlinda@gmail.com. Until next time, we hope you continue to get lit.